Welcome to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM CFRO. The date is September 28th, 2009. This is Monday Brown Bagger. My name is Reginald Angus Argue. Before I get to our guest and also get to the gentleman who's going to be sitting in for the next couple shows and hopefully for a long time with this show with me, Kevin Kelso, I would like to quickly say that today's show is not meant in any way to be against ordinary British people. What we're going to be doing is we're going to be focusing on the hierarchy cancer of the British monarchy and their bloodthirsty quest to control and manipulate every nation in the world with their out-of-date, draconian, free trade policies and totalitarian reaction of thumping on anyone who may perceive to be their opponent with the swiftest and deadliest of action, both economically and physically. Looking at our times, we're seeing the end result of how the trade policies have been obliterating the United States, Canada, Mexico, and third world countries, who are now sent into a worldwide financial crisis, while a few like the British monarchy and other leaders from the G20 continue to bull right over top of our rights and freedoms. With all this said, this is why I support pulling Canada and the United States out of all free trades, severing our ties with the British Crown, and the nation of Canada becoming a republic where every Canadian would have equal rights and freedoms. With that said, I'd like to introduce our guest, Paul Glumas, who is a writer, public speaker, and a member of the Lyndon LaRouche movement. Hello, Paul?
Yes, hello.
Well, thank you very much for coming on. Could you quickly tell the audience a little bit more about yourself?
Well, I'm active in the Northwest, Washington State and British Columbia, with the political movement of Lyndon LaRouche. And we have regular meetings every 2 weeks in Vancouver. And we're the movement that is at the center of waging the battle to determine what's going to replace this totally collapsing financial system. And it's based basically on the idea of the sovereign nation. The sovereign nations have the right to create the credit, to wipe out all the bad paper, and work out agreements between them to get back to a system that in which nations can prosper. And so that's what's going to be decided in the next month or two as this financial system comes down. And Mr. LaRouche, who I'm active with, is playing a very key role in the United States. And we're seeking to bring the United States, Russia, China, and India in the middle of the collapse, which we expect this coming month, to essentially overthrow the empire and create a fixed exchange between them and overthrow the empire once and for all. So this is the reality. And if we don't do that, then we're going to have chaos because the financial system, their financial system, is collapsing and can't be saved.
And also, correct me if I'm wrong, you were born in Canada, you spent some time in Mexico.
No, I was born in Mexico, but I was partly raised in Canada and partly raised in the United States. My mother's Canadian.
So,
and my mother's relatives are all in Canada.
So you actually, you're familiar with all the economical, the way it works in Canada, United States, and Mexico?
Yes.
And also, at the same time, I'd like to quickly hand the mic over to Kevin Kelso and get him to introduce himself. So just give a little bit of, tell the listening audience a little bit about yourself, Kevin.
Thanks, Reg. Yeah, my name is Kevin Kelso. I have a website, kevinkelso.ca. I'm running in the next federal election for the Canadian Action Party. Real quickly, our principles are to give the power back to the Bank of Canada, the power to issue credit, as opposed to what we have now, which is a system that the Canadian government is borrowing 97% of its credit from private banks. We pay $107 billion a year in interest for that, or at least last year we did. We are also about abrogating free trade and promoting sovereignty for Canada, very important to us, and as well as demanding a new investigation into the crimes of 9/11.
Well, thank you very much, Sir Kevin. And Paul, I wanted to quickly focus on you for a moment, if I may. Yeah, if we, the people of North America, would have learned from our past, we should have paid attention to what happened in Ireland, India, and other nations under this British Empire when they had their free trade policies. Could you tell us, you wrote an article called Then and Now, British Empire Policies Mean Famine. Could you tell us a little bit about what you wrote about what happened in India in regards to the famine and also what happened in Ireland?
Well, let me preface it first by giving you a bigger conception of it. What people don't realize is that the English-speaking world in the 1700s, latter 1700s, there was a battle between two tendencies. One was led by Lord Shelburne, who became the principal person in the emerging British East India Company. And the other person was led by Benjamin Franklin. The other faction was led by Benjamin Franklin. They had a different point of view. Benjamin Franklin's idea was that the English-speaking world would develop industry, science, and promote manufacturers. And the view of the British East India Company, Lord Shelburne, was to return people to a condition of abject poverty and rule through a kind of looting of the populations of the world. But the problem they had was, how do you keep an empire going and crush the resistance of whatever population, you, especially India, or by then the British East India Company was taking over India. How do you resist that? So they developed a number of different methods for preventing the resistances from overthrowing them. And one of them was modeled on the work that Lord Shelburne commissioned the historian Gibbons when he wrote The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. The two things that were key from that was the example of Julian the Apostate, the Roman Emperor, was you have religious wars. You create conflicts between religions. And to this day, you have everywhere in the world where there is a significant religious conflict, if you trace it historically, it was created by this empire. And it's continued to be maintained by that empire, like the situation in the Middle East or the Hindu versus Muslim. You can go all around the world. The second thing was that Gibbon said that the problem that brought down Rome was the concept of man that was embedded in Christianity and Judaism. And that concept of man was not of an animal or a beast or someone who, or of an individuals who would accept rule. So therefore, you had to eliminate that concept, because the resistance to the Roman Empire came spiritually from this idea that human beings were more than animals. So essentially, you have to go after that. And the third thing, very key, was that to control a population, you have to keep them in constant condition of either dying of famine or facing famine, because that's how you get them to do what you want. And this was no better example of this than what happened in India. Okay? And the British came into India as a private firm, which took over the tax farming rights starting in the area of Bengal where Calcutta is today. And and I'll quote you from Warren Hastings, the company's chief officer, notwithstanding the loss of at least one-third of the inhabitants of the province and consequent decrease in cultivation, net collections of the year 1771 exceeded those of 1768. It was naturally to be expected that the diminution of the revenue should have kept an equal pace with the other consequences of so great a calamity. They're talking about a famine, a massive famine. That it did not was owing to it being violently kept up to its former standard. So here you have the method of forcing exports from India of food and different things for the empire while a famine is raging and people are dying in the millions. And then later, this same system was used to force people off the land to work in the slave labor projects that built up the infrastructure of rule later on, after the company went bankrupt because they couldn't run India. They needed to expand the infrastructure, and they couldn't get the people to work. So under the Crown Colony, under the colonial system, they'd actually induce famines every 2 years. So basically, from about 1100 to 1764, when the British East India come in, there were only 14 major famines in India in 600 to 700 years. And then under the company rule, which was a little less than 100 years, there were 16 major famines. And then under the British Colonial Office, there was a major famine in India every 2 years. And the population of India stayed pretty much the same, at about 220 million throughout that entire period. So that is how they ruled India, and that's how they got the cheap labor, break it from the caste system to do the building of railways and other infrastructure of rule. And that's the system that was also used in Ireland when the potato famine hit. They used the potato famine, which the Irish people could have been kept alive during those 4 years, because there was plenty of other food being produced. Potatoes were primarily being produced in the poor hilly areas in the western and southwestern part of Ireland. But they didn't allow that food to be used for the Irish people. They exported it all, and they did not interfere with the export of the goods. And in the course of this, over a million Irish left, and I believe over a million died, and it might be a lot more than that. And the population of Ireland at that time was 8 million. It is now, if you combine the North and the Republic of Ireland, it's about 6 million. So you essentially have the same, similar situation as with India. So that's the third thing. And the fourth thing is a policy that the British East India Company developed in the early part of the 1800s, which was the drug trade. And the financial power that still controls the drug trade today, which is a huge a huge financial power, is today the same empire, the same families, the same banks, the same continuation of that is today. And that's what you're dealing with. That's another part of the empire that you're dealing with. And any attempt to shut down the drug trade by any country will be met with severe response from the empire itself.
And I'd like to quickly point out there, Paul, also during the Irish famine, apparently the warehouses over in England were full of food, and yet the rich landowners who were English refused to share it with the Irish people.
Exactly. And the reason they said was because they didn't want to interfere with the magic of the marketplace.
And if we take a look at today's marketplace and we take a look at the free trade, the NAFTA, and all these agreements, we're looking at all these businesses being farmed out, shipped out, manufacturing being shut down, and we're actually seeing people moved as commodities throughout North America. Example here in British Columbia, here in Vancouver, there was a project where they brought in people from Brazil, and they're paying them after they paid for their so-called living expenses, about $4 an hour they're paying them. And that's in nowadays, right? And quickly, I'd like to basically, Kevin and Annette wanted to quickly say a point right now. Go ahead, Kevin.
Hi. I wanted to just add that the whole thing of even referring to the Irish famine as a famine, I think, is wrong, because it was deliberately created. It was an act of genocide. There was lots of wheat and cattle being shipped out of England all during that time because of the trade laws they had. And the English concocted this notion that there was this natural disaster called a famine to cover the fact that they deliberately killed all those people. And also the population of Ireland is just under 4 million, not 6. So I just wanted to...
You mean right now?
Yeah.
Okay, I was counting the north and the south, but anyhow.
Yeah, so am I. Yeah.
Okay. All right. But well, then I got it wrong off the computer.
Well, that's okay.
Sorry about that. No, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. It shouldn't be called a famine. It was a deliberate genocide, and the British were very upset because the Irish, who were using potatoes, had a certain independence from them. They couldn't control them because they lived off the potato and They were independent, and they very much despised that condition. They wanted either dead or a slave.
I have a question for Kevin Kelso, and also for you, Paul, and hopefully Kevin, and then I'll get you to answer this one right after these Kevin and Paul answer. The question I have, if we take a look at nowadays, how can we, people of Canada and people of the United States, because some of our listeners are out of the United States, what steps can we take to stop this madness of free trade, and what policies can we bring in which will benefit the people and employ the people and properly manage our natural resources? Paul, can I get you to answer that one first, please?
Okay. The moment is coming very soon where that issue will be decided. It's not just a question of what would be nice to be adopted. There will be a total crisis, most likely between the second and third and fourth week of October. It's coming very soon. And Lyndon LaRouche, in concert with many forces now in the U.S. and internationally, are preparing to move in with an emergency policy that ends free trade on a global scale, that ends the financial system of toxic waste and financial speculation, and that aims to keep people in their homes, that aims to keep people fed during this crisis, and then use the credit to promote the development of the nation. And whatever, now we have a problem because of free trade. No nation, except maybe India at this point in history, has actually economic self-sufficiency, even in food. So it's a real mess. But nations can sort it out in terms of how they're going to go back to societies that nations which actually produce most of what they consume internally through protected agreements in terms of trade and so forth. That's on the agenda. That's not, you know, wouldn't it be nice? That's on the agenda because the whole system of hyper-expanding financial aggregates and hyper-expanding monetary aggregates to bail out that system is coming to a crushing end very soon. The Federal Reserve is totally put the entire U.S. and all the financial paper on life support right now, and they won't even disclose who they're lending money to and what they're taking in response and so forth and so on. They're buying half of the U.S. Treasury notes. The system is going under, and it will most likely go under by the 12th of October or somewhat thereafter. And there is no way to stop, ultimately, the whole thing from collapsing. And so in that emergency, in that crisis, we believe it is possible that nations can defeat the empire, and you got to have the four biggest nations work together on this: Russia, China, India, and the United States. Otherwise, you don't have the sufficient power to crush this empire. This empire is huge. It's enormous. It's the biggest it's ever been in history, and it's global. And it will, it can be crushed at this point, or else there's chaos, because they can't control what comes after the crash. It'll be chaos.
And I'd like to quickly point out, here in British Columbia, we're seeing the effects of free trade again by we're having corporations coming in here and stealing the natural resources from the First Nations people and the non-First Nations people who make up Canada. Kanata means village, so everyone that lives in that village. We're having billions of dollars a year for well over 30 years being stolen from us, the people of Canada, or you can call it Kanata if you wish. And what happens is, if we didn't have that free trade, we would have proper trade practices put in place, proper management of natural resources, proper sharing of the resources, that every single person in Canada should get access to free universal health care and free, basically, education. And our taxes that we pay should be 1% to 2% maximum, which the natural resources paying for all this stuff. And we have billions upon billions of dollars throughout Canada, probably all the way up into the hundreds of billions of dollars we could have each year that could be paying for all this stuff. But we're not paying for it because these corporations, under the illusion of what they call free, is actually nothing more than they're stealing our rights and freedoms. And I'd like to hand the mic over to Kevin Kelso, if you could quickly comment, and then I'll get Kevin and Annette to jump in right after that.
Sure. Well, what my comment would be is how the free trade system actually works. And basically, resources are taken from their native region, whether it's Africa, Canada, or wherever. They're exported to through a middleman who makes most of the profit, leeches off the wealth. They're refined elsewhere by basically slave labor, and then they're sold back to the nation that they came from and other nations for a much higher price, and all of that the value that's lost in between goes to a very small, thin crust of elite and rich individuals.
Kevin Annette, can I get you to jump in now, please?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's often described as free trade is counterposed to protectionism, and in a country like Canada, which historically has had such a small population and market in comparison to America, would obviously be swamped unless its industries were protected. And that, you know, that's been broken down consistently by largely by the Liberal Party, which has been the government of continental integration with the U.S. And right now, we are essentially integrated with the American economy and the North American Union. And we can disagree or agree over the details, but basically that's in effect. There's George Orwell's vision of the world has come about. There's three power blocks, and we're in one of them. And I think to look at it in the big scale, the entire world economy is heading for disaster. And I don't believe that anybody's actually in charge of it. I think that they're creating the illusion with this pandemic scare and everything that there's a lot of police state measures coming. But A, it's not possible to impose those. And B, even if they did, it wouldn't avert disaster. So I think we have to realize that the power to change is always in our own hands locally. The problem is that we've all been raised to be slaves. None of us have ever had experience of sovereignty and democracy. And we have to start asserting that personally and in our community. So I think the solution is not just economic. Economically, we have to take back, you know, the credit, the supply of the economy, and we've got to establish local trading and exchange networks. We have to actually take back every aspect of our existence. So to talk about economic solutions in isolation to that, I think is really begs the bigger question of what we're part of.
Well, thank you very much for that point there, Kevin. And also, I'd like to quickly point out that it was the federal Liberal Party that brought in Lafarge. Lafarge is the biggest cement company throughout Canada and United States, and is out of France, headquartered out of France. And so what we've seen here in British Columbia, we're seeing Lafarge and also another company called Ashgrove. If the people do their research, they'll find out. These two companies are draining us dry. They're also doing it over in Manitoba. And these two companies were kicked out of Venezuela. Venezuela basically told them to get out, had to pay them off in order to get rid of them. But anyway, we have to wrap up pretty quick. So, Paul, can I quickly get you to say some last minutes, because we have to go on to the next guest pretty soon.
Okay. You're all invited to the next chapter meeting in Vancouver, which is Saturday the 10th at 7 p.m. at 5024 Rumble in Burnaby. And you can email me at my name, Paul, P-A-U-L, Glumaz, G-L-U-M-A-Z, at hotmail.com if you want more information. But I want to emphasize that everything will be different in the consciousness of the people that you look at who you think are asleep, and they are, will be different very soon, because they're going to wake up in a kind of massive Pearl Harbor type situation where the crisis is so great that their minds are going to shift, and they're going to be open to the kind of things you're talking about. But only in such a crisis could their minds open up to such changes.
Well, thank you very much, Paul. And I'd like to quickly point out, before handing the mic over to Kevin Kelso, to quickly say some final points too before we go on. I was at a rally on Saturday, and I was protesting the vaccine. And someone started talking about the Canadian Oath Keeper oath that we, because I'm a veteran of Canadian military. And this old guy was saying, if you don't like it, you should leave. So this old guy is from the old guard, is telling us new guard, why don't you just shut up and get to the back of the bus? And I say to the old guard that us people who believe in sovereignty, who believe in freedom, believe in everyone should have the right that we should stand next to our brothers and sisters who are First Nations, who are Afro-Canadians, who are Jamaicans, who are Irish, who are Scottish. It doesn't matter if you're a Canadian. And also at the same time, I extend the exact same invitation to the American people, because you're our brothers and sisters. We stand next to each other and we say, we want our freedoms back. The old guard, if you don't like it, you should leave, is what I say to them, because the day of freedom is coming. It is coming. The revolution is starting pretty soon. That's what I see happening. That's my humble opinion. Now I'd like to hand the mic over to Kevin Kelso.
Thanks, Reg. Yeah, I really respect your passion, and I agree. I feel every day that the revolution is becoming stronger, and there really is one happening in the masses, and even at the higher levels with the politicians, some of them are starting to come around and see that they've been tricked, and you know, some of them actually want what's best for the country, and they're realizing that what they've been doing wasn't that. So that you know, we can't give up hope that those people at the top can change too. And I've been a part of trying to change their minds. I've gone to the Liberal convention and tried to get them to wake up and see what's really going on. I wanted to make another point on what Kevin Annette said. I do believe in protectionism, but not isolationism. There is a way to have international trade between nations and still retain sovereignty. What there was up until 1971 was this thing called the Bretton Woods Agreement. It allowed for long-term contracts between nations that trading, you know, they would trade goods for you know, credit. And what happens now is that the currency that is owed, it changes in value, so you don't get paid back in the same value as what you traded for. At the time, though, there was you could make agreements that you would basically get paid back in the same value of what you owed, and that could promote the development of both countries. If you develop third world nations, you can actually stabilize the populations of places like China and India. If you look at any first world nation, the population stabilizes. So instead of, you know, this predatory system of looting nations that can't help themselves, they're too weak, we help develop them, and then we wind up getting a lot more back.
So in other words, what you're talking about is being your true brother and sister keeper, and you're looking at it from a world standpoint, whereas everyone is sovereign in their own nation, but yet we still have to work together as brothers and sisters.
Absolutely.
Well, I hate to cut this conversation off at this time, but we have to go on to our next guest. I thank you so much for coming on there, Paul Glumas.
Okay.
And we're going to invite you back on, because we need to get this kind of lively discussion out there and inform the people. Saturday night over at Burnaby, Rumble, over at the, can you say that address again so the listening audience can check
in? Saturday the 10th, 5024 Rumble, 7 p.m., and it's the O-Lions Club there.
So if anyone wants to come out, you're listening right now, you want to come out, you want to meet Paul, you want to meet Kevin, I'm going to go there and watch it too. So if you want to come and have a discussion with any of us, just come out and listen to what Paul has to say. Very informed individual. Thank you so much for Paul for coming on.
Thank you very much.
This is Co-op Radio 102.7 FM CFRO, Monday Brown Bagger. It's September 28th. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll come back with our next guest. Welcome back to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM CFRO. This is Monday Brown Bagger. My name is Reginald Angus Argue. Before I introduce the next guest and hand the mic over to Kevin to say a couple more points, George W. Bush is coming to Edmonton, Alberta on October 20th, 2009. There's some groups out of Edmonton I'd like to put a shout out to you. Expose Tyranny, and also there's a Bill Thompson Thomas. And what happened was I was handed this open letter invitation to all activist groups, political parties, and anti-poverty groups, labor groups, unions, charity organizations, student unions, clubs, groups of universities and college, city hall counselors, community leagues, peace groups, and of course, all people of Edmonton. George W. Bush, President, 43rd President of the United States, will be speaking in Edmonton, Alberta at the Shaw Conference Center on Tuesday, October 20th, 2009, 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. This planned protest has been formed for the people of Alberta and beyond who believe that George W. Bush is a war criminal and that he should be not welcomed in our province except with a pair of handcuffs and a ticket to an international criminal court. As President of the United States, Bush presided over most unpopular presidency, both within the United States and around the world. He turned widespread sympathy for the American people after 9/11 attacks into fear, disgust, and disbelief at the execution of the so-called war on terror, which included the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq. And I'd also like to point out that both those wars are illegal, in my humble opinion. The charges of war crimes, which are being researched and carried forth by hundreds of lawyers and activists of all political stripes within the United States and around the world, arise from the illegal invasion of Iraq, now widely acknowledged to have been started under false pretenses and in the breach of United Charter of international laws. The war in Iraq has claimed the lives of innocent citizens, Iraqis estimated to number in the hundreds of thousands to over a million. In addition, more than 400,000 U.S. soldiers have perished, with tens of thousands more injured, not to mention Canadian involvement. And there's a couple more paragraphs with the letter, but we have to go on to our next guest. But I'd like to quickly point out that a long time ago, I was pointed out that the actual true number of U.S. soldiers that died over in Iraq is much higher because they don't account for the people that die once they get over to Germany or back in the United States. All they're counting for people that die in the theater of war is what they're accounting for. The numbers, actually, what I've heard, are actually all the way up into either 15,000 or well over 20,000. Now, with that said, I'd like to say to the people that are going to be doing this protest, thank you so much for doing it. And if anyone else wants to contact one of the people involved with this, again, go into Facebook, type in "Expose Tyranny." And that's one of the gentlemen that he can hook you up with the people who are involved with this. So I say to the listening audience, if you want to get involved with it, October 20th, 2009, and you want to be in Edmonton, Alberta, and protest with them, you want to join up with the groups there, just to talk to that person. Now, I'd like to basically introduce our next guest. Name is Trevor Lyman. He's from the United States of America. He's a musician and internet music entrepreneur. He became famous for organizing grassroots fundraising for the 2008 United States Republican presidential candidate Ron Paul, congressman from Texas. Trevor is noted for popularizing such campaign concepts as money bombs and dedicated political blimp advertising. Hello, Trevor.
Hey, Reginald. How are you?
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I mean, you're a pure example of a patriot from the United States, from the younger generation, just like this Kevin Kelso who's sitting right across from me. Both of you are examples of the younger generation coming of age and standing up for the rights and freedoms of the people. And I noticed in my research that one of the reasons why you became involved with Ron Paul was because of this illegal war over in Iraq. And, you know, I did almost 9 years in the Canadian military in 1988. I went over to Iran, so I know what it's like over in that area of the world. And not in any way do I support the ideas of war. I support bringing all our troops home, and I support taking that money and putting it forth to help out the people of United States and Canada, is what I support. So could you quickly comment why you talk a little bit about why you joined up with the Ron Paul campaign?
Sure. Yeah. It was a series of events that I guess first started to get me more interested in politics. It was the war mostly. I mean, obviously there were other things going on as well. And then through the things that happened in Congress, which basically, I mean, the short answer of what happened was that the Congress completely ignored the American people. When that happened, when they said that they were, I mean, the Democrats in 2006 ran on the campaign of getting us out of the war. Absolutely, that was the verbiage that they used every step of the way. And I was stunned. I was just shocked that, you know, right after the elections, Nancy Pelosi, one of the very first things she did was say, you know, you voted for a change in strategy on the war. You know, just completely twisted it. And not only did they not end the war, they gave us a troop surge. They increased the war by three times. Here was a, you know, this was they were running on ending the war, and then suddenly they increased troops by three. I couldn't think of a bigger slap in the face for something, you know, with something more horrible than war. So at that point, I knew that, you know, our country was absolutely broken. And, you know, there were many things that attracted me to Ron Paul. But one of them, because my trust was so just shredded at that point, one main element, despite all of his, you know, in addition to all of his positions that I agreed with, was that he had consistently voted for the Constitution for 30 years, never once going against it. So I, you know, at least now I had a candidate in front of me that was saying the right things, but also did the right thing for 30 years. So, you know, it that kind of trust, you know, you really need that after an experience like we had.
And I'd like to quickly talk a little bit about the G20 meeting, which just happened over in Pittsburgh. I was watching some of the films of this, and there was one where there's students standing in the stairwell over in the university that they have over there. And there's this bridge that goes from one tower to the other tower, and then there's a street underneath. And the police were pushing the protesters back, and there were students minding their own business, just taking pictures. And then all of a sudden, these tear gas canisters started to be shot into the stairwell. The police went at the bottom. The police went at the top. Wouldn't allow the students to get out of there. Now, speaking from personal experience, when I was in the military, and I went through the gas huts with tear gas there, we had to run into the gas hut, pull our gas mask out of its container, and throw the gas mask on. And, you know, you get whiffs of tear gas in your eyes, and it just burns like anything. And also at the same time, I'd like to quickly point this out. When I was over in basic training, there was a couple individuals who were forced to run through the gas huts without gas masks on. And right afterwards, I saw them standing off the side, and they're just, their eyes are all watering, they're vomiting and everything else. So when I saw these students being forced to stay there and forced to have to endure the effects of tear gas, my memory went back to watching these two other individuals back in basic training when I was in the Canadian military. And, you know, that's just, all of a sudden, an awful lot of anger started to boil up inside of me. But I was wondering if you had a chance to take a look at some of the stuff that's happened in G20 in regards to the protesting, and give us some quick comments on that, Trevor?
Sure. I've seen some of the videos. You know, they're so, it's like a full frontal assault with everything that they do, that the government does, that's against the Constitution and illegal in one way or another. That you know, it's so hard to keep up with everything. You know what I mean? So, you know, fortunately, I think that, you know, we're focusing on the Fed and things like that here, which, you know, money is a big part of all of these problems, these symptoms that we have. I believe the war is a symptom of the Federal Reserve, because without the funding, you can't have the war. And I wish that there were greater resistance to what's going on with the police in our country right now, because, you know, it is it's outrageous. It's also very interesting how they certainly started to do this more and more at different types of rallies, but it's very selective. You know, the G20 is the most violent of them. It's sort of like they go against the left here, because they have the ability to paint the left as violent and radical, just because they're the most outspoken, and the media will twist what they do into, you know, oh, well, we need the security for these people because, you know, they portray them as anarchists, this kind of thing. But you'll notice that other protests that happen in this country don't have any police presence. So it's very selective, and it feels very orchestrated. They're going against, you know, those that will protest, again, the left people, because of, you know, just of how they're positioning them. They're using any kind of agitation or the appearance of possibly being violent or whatever to be their excuse to go in and do these things, and they're upping incrementalism in the tactics that they're using against people. And I didn't see the one that you're referring to, but I did see one where there were police all lined up and protesters standing around a good 30, 40, 50 yards in between the protesters and the police, probably as many police as protesters. It seemed to be in some back road area that really wasn't very populated. There really wasn't much going on. It was just somebody YouTubing, you know, as they were standing around. And then suddenly the police turn on their sound cannons and begin tapping their shields all in unison, and a pre-recorded voice comes over the phone, over the megaphone, saying that, you know, you have to move. This is an unlawful assembly, which, of course, is an absolute lie. There was absolutely nothing unlawful going on. And basically at that point, they just enforced their will. There was no law broken. It's now becoming policemen being able to just enforce their will. You know, we don't want you here, therefore you can't be here. And that's never been what we've had in our country. It's alarming. It's scary. And, you know, I hope that we can wheel around and fight this back. I think that, you know, different cities, they need to be taken to court. And we just need to push as hard as we can against it.
Yeah, when I was watching that, I think I saw that exact same YouTube there, Trevor. And it took me back to my memories when I was in training in the military. And actually, we were taught how to do crowd control, and we were taught with certain movement. And as you're saying, in unison, just the way that our feet would hit the ground. Now, what happens is, I believe the people have the right to assembly. I believe the people have the right to protest. And, you know, what the police did there was out of this world. And their actions was similar to a Stalinist ideology, and the way that it's almost like United States, I feel, is starting to turn into the United Soviet States, is what I feel like, that basically that they're starting to seize the control over the American people. And actually here in Canada, the way that the First Nations people have been treated throughout, ever since Canada's been in existence, has been nothing more than a testing ground, because everything up here that's happened here in Canada is now starting to happen in the United States. And, you know, I really, my heart goes out to the United States, and I hope that one day we, the people of Canada and the United States, are able to stand up against this madness and just say, enough, we want our sovereignty back, we want our freedom back, we want the right to have all Canadians, all Americans, to have the right to freedom and have our flags flying high as we embrace the First Nations and non-First Nations partnership. I'd like to quickly hand the mic over to Kevin Kelso. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that these heavy-handed responses to protests and don't forget provocateurs where police infiltrate groups and promote violence so that they can respond violently, it's all to discourage peaceful protest. Speaking of peaceful protest, I want to point out that Tony Blair is coming to Surrey on October 6th, and I think it's just as important that we make a strong showing there. I know there's some planned protests going to be going on there already. Tony Blair is he's the former Prime Minister of Britain, but he's still very influential and still working very hard to promote this British Empire thing, which is still going on. I want to point out that, I want to talk about the American system of nation-state economics. There was a revolution that went on. It's called the American Revolution. You might have heard of it. It was actually a revolution against the British Empire. There were people that came over with the intention of colonizing this continent. Yes, they wanted to, you know, promote slavery. But there was also people that, you know, came over with the intention of creating a new system, bringing the best aspects of European civilization and creating a system that was contrary to imperialism. Reductionist history seems to neglect this fact, but what they did was they created a system that was actually meant to allow the nation to be prosperous and independent of the empire. This system was successful in that. They transformed a wilderness in about 30 years into a very prosperous industrial nation that could destroy the empire, which was a big threat to that empire. And they actually became a beacon for other nations to pick up the system, and they could ditch the free trade imperial system. Other nations did pick that up, Russia, Germany, and Japan. And there's a lot of evidence that says that because the empire was threatened by these four nations using that system, that they were manipulated into fighting each other in World War II and destroying each other.
Well, thank you very much for that point there, Kevin. That was you have some more?
Go ahead, and there's Kevin. The other thing to continue on that, the U.S. Constitution was created in that spirit, and it legally embodies it's a legal embodiment of those ideas. So the United States will, as long as it exists, it will forever embody that, and that will always be the law of America, which means that it will inevitably go back to the Constitution at some point and be the beacon of hope and freedom for the world again. It's just a matter of time.
Well, thank you very much there, Kevin. Trevor, I wanted to quickly get to this, the money bomb thing. I know that you weren't the person that came up with the idea, but you're one of the main people that implemented this idea. Could you tell us how to put this in place? Because people like Kevin Kelso, who's running in the next federal Canadian election up here, how can we help out young gentlemen like him and others so that we can basically implement this money bomb to help out get the proper people in power?
Sure. Well, money bombs are events really where people come together to. Before I get to go to that, I just want to touch real quick on the point that Kevin you made about pitting the nations against each other. I don't really know much about that, but I will say that I've heard that central banks, such as I believe the same bankers that are in charge of the Federal Reserve, the same families like the Rothschild or different. Big names like that, Carnegie, et cetera.
It all started in London.
Pretty sure they funded both sides of the war.
Always.
Like World War II, they funded the Nazis and they funded the Allies. So, right. I think that really supports what you're saying. Unless I have a fact wrong, but I'm pretty sure that the bankers, and that's why I cite them as one of the main problems in our nation right now, if not the main problem.
Yeah, you've got it right. I just want to point out that it's not just the Federal Reserve and those people, but also the international banking cartels.
Bank of England, too.
Centered in London, yeah. So in a sense, it's an international thing, and it's a continuation of the British Empire, which sort of went underground, and it all comes from London and is extended through America.
Right, right. Exactly, because they had a lot to do with, I think, our current banking system, too. At least some of the same bankers that have power there have power here now, I believe.
Yes.
So for money bombs, basically what I think excites people about money bombs, there's two major elements. One is the candidate and the message. If you have a good candidate and message, then, obviously you've got to build momentum and get people to know about it. Once you've established some momentum and you've got your channels and you're making progress and spreading the word, you can then ask that people will sort of take an action if X number of people take the same action. And so it's a multiplier effect. It's basically the concept of, a drop of water combined with millions of other drops creates a huge tidal wave of force and power. And that's basically, the whole concept. And it's very motivating to, if you have a pledge, that says, I will pledge $100, and you can see that 5,000 other people have pledged the same amount, or 1,000, or 200, or whatever it is, the higher the number, the better, that you're going to turn your $100 into a million, or whatever the case may be, or 100,000 that day. And that's a very motivating and empowering action. So that's the gist of what money bombs are. They're very simple. They're word of mouth and viral campaigns on the internet. It's just basically you set up a site that where you can take pledges. People can pledge to whatever the amount is. They enter their email address to pledge. That way you can contact them and say, okay, pledge date is now here. You pledged to give us $100 on X date. That's now here. So please go ahead and make good with your pledges. And at that point, everybody comes together and does it, and then the money bomb is successful.
You're also involved with called Break the Matrix. Excuse me. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that was an attempt to put together some media or a media company that might be able to take the message from online to offline. That project wasn't able to get the funding that was required. We wanted to take on the mainstream media, so it was going to require a significant amount of money. So at the moment, that isn't quite going as strong as it was, but I've gone back to trying to help candidates raise money is where my focus is mostly going these days.
And you were also involved with getting that blimp together with Ron Paul on the side of it and his message?
That's right. Yep. We were having so much trouble getting Ron Paul in the news, that we were trying to come up with lots of different ideas. And the idea for the blimp really came about prematurely before we had the money to be able to do it. So I introduced it, and people liked it. Some people didn't, but either way, we realized there wasn't enough money. After this November 5th and after that money bomb where we were able to raise, millions in a day, 4.2 or 3, people decided that, hey, well, maybe we can give that blimp a shot. And so momentum began to pick up for that again, and we went ahead and did a fundraiser for it and flew the blimp up and down the East Coast, mostly from D.C. down to Florida, and sort of ran a route that way, which it worked out fairly well because there were some primaries in South Carolina and other events that we were able to get the blimp close to.
We only have Well, excuse me for interrupting you, Trevor. We only have about 2 minutes left. Can we quickly get some last words from you? So listening audience, if they're interested in emailing you or contacting you, could you quickly say some stuff?
Sure. You can, if anybody wants to email me, my email is usually at the bottom of whatever money bomb I'm throwing. So you could go to thisnovember5th.com and my email's at the bottom of that. But I heard something, I think, in the previous half hour where someone was mentioning that we've come a long way and we're making a lot of progress. Things like G20, they are very upsetting, and they are progress in the wrong direction. But I believe we are also making significant progress in the right directions. And we may even be coming, and not on every issue there's a stalemate, but on some issues we're making such progress, maybe we're getting close to some kind of stalemate, or at least I'm hopeful that we will soon. And once we've achieved that, then it's all about continuing the momentum until we take our country back. At that point, every day gets a little better. I think we're getting close to that. So I would just say to everyone that, who is pushing the ideals of freedom, that we just need to keep being loud because it's working. And we should have faith and be very proud of what we've accomplished in the face of people who really seem to lost their sense of humanity.
I agree with you totally there, Trevor. The reason why I'm saying that, because the end of September 2001, right up to the middle of September 2006, I was forced into exile out of this nation that I was born in, the nation I served the military, all because a few individuals didn't like my writing. After the death threats, hitting the sidewalk, cars driving in front of old house, jail threats, being forced out of this nation for that period of time. What I'm noticing now is the old guard, they're still continuing to threaten me, but I'm actually noticing more allies standing next to me. So I believe that the people are starting to stand up. I believe that the old guard's tactics of old are becoming old, and we're stopping them. We the people are starting to stand up and say no more. And I love it seeing young people like Kevin here and others standing next to me and saying, no, you can't, we won't allow you to do this stuff anymore. With that said, Kevin, we've got about 30 seconds for you just to quickly say some final words, and then we have to go on to the next show. It's going to come back on.
Okay, yeah. I just want to put things into perspective on this money bomb idea. You can spend $200 easily going to a hockey game. Think about how much you waste on booze and clothes and that kind of thing. It's not hard to loosen your purse strings for something that really matters. If you wanted to go to my website, it's kevinkelso.ca, updating it quite a bit real soon. And my email is savethehumans911@gmail.com.
Well, thank you very much for coming on there, Trevor Lyman, and also Kevin Kelso. My name is Reginald Angus Argue. This is Monday Brown Bagger, September 28th. Thank you so much, and have a beautiful day.